Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 304 for October 2nd of 2015, One Badass Tacoma. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary Vaslash, let's do a show right now.
Why don't we do that?
Okay.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Good.
You?
Excellent. I was driving a Volt yesterday in California.
Oh, the new Volt.
And all the goodness that I did for the environment, I got rid of today. I drove a Ford GT with a 5-liter engine over to the studio today. So just wiped all that goodness. But it was a
Mustang GT.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very nice car.
And we got to let everybody know we've got Chris Pockert with us today.
Great to be
with
back.
With CNET.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If you were actually driving the actual GT, I probably would have just taken my mic off and walked outside.
Yeah. Then that would have been the end of the show.
It would.
No, we're taking the cameras out with us.
Yeah. That's right. And I'm driving a Bentley today, so.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Which one?
The Mulsanne Speed.
Oh.
It's like driving an English library. It's
When you work for CNET, you just do those sorts of things.
That's right. But we got to let everybody know we've got Mike Swears, chief engineer on the Toyota, well, I should say Toyota Trucks, because we had you here, I think, 2 years ago with the Tundra. Now we've got you here with the Tacoma.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and I'm driving a Tundra today, so it's almost like a Bentley.
Yeah.
It's about the same size, but less torque.
Yeah.
And you could carry a library in it.
Yes. Yeah, I've got the 8-foot bed on the back, so yeah, I can pretty much carry a smart vehicle in the back there.
There you go.
But we got your latest baby in the studio with us here, the new Tacoma. And so it's on sale right now, but it's still not everywhere, right? You're still selling the old one.
We've stopped production of the old one. They're being delivered. The new ones are being built right now, and they're in transit. So they should be at the dealer shortly.
What's the reaction so far?
It's been very positive. It's an exciting product. You know, it's an area that we don't really have to pump up a Tacoma owner about a new Tacoma. They're very enthusiastic about their vehicles. And with the new styling, really focusing on that desert racer theme, we've had nothing but positive reactions to the styling and the grade strategy that we put forth.
So of the two trucks, this Tacoma has always been Toyota's main stalwart vehicle.
Well, in North America,
in
right?
North America, right.
So Toyota, and a lot of people don't know this, but we're number one in trucks globally. We sell more trucks than anyone else.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Really?
And our number one vehicle is what we call an IMV or a Hilux truck that's sold overseas. We don't sell it here. We sell in Mexico and other places. But the Hilux lineup, we sell about 1.1 million trucks a year. Hmm. And then in North America, we have Tundra and Tacoma. And Tacoma has been number one in the compact segment for the last 10 years running. So it's, as we started this program and I was given the responsibility for it, it was some big shoes to fill. You start wondering about how to change it and still keep it in the segment where it's been for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So you referenced the Hilux. How similar are those two vehicles? Because they appear very similar in terms of size and mission, but you're running these two very different trucks in global markets, and I think in Mexico, don't you offer both?
We offer both in Mexico. And the Tacoma in Mexico is kind of the highline truck, and the Hilux is more of the commercial vehicle. Actually, the Hilux platform is a different platform. It's about 8% smaller footprint than the Tacoma is. And basically, what's underneath it is similar. We share, with the new model, we share a transfer case. We share a rear diff. The rear diff for this truck is made in Arkansas, and they make theirs in Indonesia, but it's the same design. It's the BD-22A rear diff that we put under there. So as we started this program, I talked to the chief engineer in charge of the IMV or the Hilux and said, you know, what can we share? The Hilux has a great recognition for its QDR, its quality, durability, and reliability. Tacoma does as well, but it's from a country standpoint, it's made for a third world roads. And if I can take some of that extra durability and throw it in our truck, it's all the better.
Did you learn things when you were developing the Tundra that you applied to the new Tacoma?
We did. One of the examples is a rear bumper. As we looked at the rear bumper on the Tundra and the damage of the rear bumper, we put the same three-piece rear bumper. Not
explain
the same.
It, just in case anybody, because I remember you telling us.
Yeah, so it's kind of a funny story on Tundra when I was here is I have a small farm, and one summer I put three new rear bumpers on my truck.
Because you're backing into things.
I personally didn't back into it. I just want to clarify that.
Family members.
But I've got high school kids that work for me, and they kept backing into hay wagons. And so I pulled the engineer outside, and I said, hey, I want this fixed. I want a thicker bumper put on here, one that's not as easily damaged. And they went back and looked at it, and they studied where bumpers are most likely to get damaged, and they came up with this three-piece idea. So it lowers your insurance cost, it lowers your repair
because
cost.
Being three pieces, you only replace the one piece that got damaged.
Correct.
So now you've got that on the Tacoma.
Yeah, so we just built that into our truck DNA now. So it's interesting. We've been building trucks for 80 years, and what you see in front of you out here is really the summation of all that knowledge of 80 years being put in this truck. And, you know, people ask, well, where do you start? Well, Land Cruiser is really our start of our when we begin a new project. And we have Toyota design standards that we design to. But for Land Cruiser, we don't have a standard. That is the standard. And every Land Cruiser has to be better than the last one. So whatever we learn through globally through our trucks ends up in the next truck. So these type of lessons have been taken. We're putting them into the global trucks itself, not just into Tacoma, but how do we make our trucks last longer? How do we make them have better QDR? And for this segment, QDR is the number one purchase reason, so quality, durability, reliability. So making the truck last longer and doing things like, we nylon-coated all of our brake lines. We're e-coating our rear diffs. How do you get from a corrosion resistance, get that to go decades instead of years or areas like this, trying to stretch out that durability.
So why is that important to the buyer of this vehicle? Because it seems to me that the buyer of this vehicle is different than the buyer of a Tundra, meaning that, you know, as you were saying the last time you were here with a Tundra, that, you know, a lot of people use these vehicles for work, and it's, you know, whether it's on a farm or they're a contractor or in construction or what have you. But it seems to me that, you know, when I think of this, I think of guys rolling around in California and got surfboards in the back and whatnot.
Well, you're right. For Tacoma, 45% of our customers say they go off-road. Now, what they mean by off-road, I can't tell you, but...
But that's a very high number, nonetheless.
It's a very high number. And it comes back to that QDR again. Regardless of what Toyota truck, we build our reputation on QDR. But in this segment, QDR is number one. When we started this project, we went out and we asked customers, what exactly is your definition of QDR? Both our customers, our competitors' customers, and it was interesting to me because it came back, and we're still learning what customers' impressions are, because they came back and said, on a Camry, my expectation of QDR is I buy the vehicle, I take it to the dealership for regular service, for the term that I own the vehicle, and that's it. I don't have to go in for warranty, I don't have recalls, so on and so forth. But for a truck customer, it's perfectly different. Their image is, I can go anywhere I want, and I can return, regardless if it's a new truck or has 200,000 miles on it. That's QDR to them. So everything we've done in this truck is all about getting that customer where they want to go, getting them back, you know, now and 10 years from now in the truck.
How do you do that? Because making a truck last longer isn't something that you do by cutting cost. How do you balance that, keeping costs down while making the truck more robust?
That's what I used to have hair, but it's tough. It's tough because just as I mentioned, we changed the rear differential on there. And in the rear differential, we went to high strength steel. Now, we've never had a complaint in North America about our strength of our rear diff, but combining that with what we've done overseas, putting that extra durability in there allowed us to do that, but it also allowed us to take some mass out of it. Nylon coating brake lines is a cost up. There's no way around it. But the brake lines last longer. The areas that you look at, how do you take cost out is, well, are we offering the customer what the customer wants? Are we focusing on the features that the customer is asking for and not putting in things they don't want in the truck? Again, looking at the box itself or how we form the fenders and become more efficient in the plant. And how many vehicles can I build to meet customer demand and working with the plant to improve tack time on the line. These are areas that we can reduce costs that don't affect the customer or what they're seeing in the end result. So there's a lot of places to save cost that don't affect the profit or the product itself. And but they take work. You know, it's a lot of work with a lot of different functions. You know, our purchasing, working with our suppliers, it's the plant working with, you know, even the operators on the line to make sure that they can operate as efficiently as possible without making extra steps, having to go and look, you know, research where they can find their parts. They can just go down the line, pull what they need, put it on. And it really comes to the TPS, Toyota Production System, that allows us to go in and reflect on what we've done on the past truck and then put that into the new production.
So this truck is built in San Antonio.
Yep.
And you're based in Ann Arbor.
Correct.
And it was also designed in Ann Arbor, am I correct?
That's correct. The initial styling was done in Newport Beach. Mm-hmm. That's our Kelty Design Studio, Van Studio. Our production studio's in Ann Arbor, where our engineering offices are.
Did it change that much from California
no,
to Ann Arbor?
No, actually it didn't. And that, you know, that's...
Because usually the designers that come up with something beautiful and then the engineers and the manufacturing people get a hold of it and it's a box.
It's well, you know, we always joke about that. You open a magazine, you say, well, this is the initial sketches. And then you see the product and you go, well, if I squint really hard and look, mm-hmm. yeah. hold yeah. my arms out, it kind of looks like it. No, actually the initial styling, with the exception of maybe the tire profile, is really close to what Newport Beach came up with. And it was a good story in itself of teamwork because I pulled the group together, our production engineering, our stamping guys, and I said, you know, this is a really cool truck. This is a theme. I went to Kevin Hunter, who's the president of Kelty, and I said, when we started it, I said, Kevin, you know, I need a truck like that 1984 Back to the Future truck. I want that truck that everybody aspires to own. And he says, well, I understand that, but what's your theme behind the truck? And I said, well, give me a badass truck. I really want a badass truck. And it's kind of a funny story behind the badass because I have to go to the board of directors and ask for money. And I give my business case and what I'm going to do and the tooling I'll need and what we're changing in the plant. And then I always give these key words, and I gave them, well, badass. And you think after 25 years, I'd know better. And right away, all the board guys are pulling out their translator and I'm like, bad asshole, yeah. You know. You can imagine what the direct translation was. It was not one of my brighter moments. But anyways, we really focused on this Desert Racer theme, and that's what they came up with. So it's heavy in the front, light and agile in the rear, and it reflects what our customer base is doing. But what that meant is every one of these lines represents, you know, a line that you would see on a race truck. And those lines are really difficult to stamp. We violate all of our stamping rules on this truck. And I pulled our production guys aside and I said, you know, this is what we need. And they scratched their head and said, you know, there's no way. And I said, well, this is what we really need. We need to stay true to the styling. How do we do that? So they sat down, and, of course, we've got FEA where we go through and look at stamping feasibility and analysis and look at all the nodes and what can be done. And basically it all came back and said, yeah, you can't form those panels. And I said, well, if we did it the old-fashioned way, how would we do it? And they said, well, we'd make some prototype tools, some Kirksite dies, or we call them. And soft tools. And so we cut some soft tools and started working on what could we do to form it. Right down to the tailgate where we put Tacoma on the back of it. That's, again, a little old school, but I like it. So
it looks cool.
It looks cool. But
it's, and others are starting to do that too now.
Yeah, and we're stamping inboard instead of raising the leathers out. We stamp them in. That catches light, and it changes the appearance of it as you walk around. That's one of the things Kelty came up with. But it makes the stamping all that more difficult.
So is it Toyota or Tundra on the back of the Tundra that you guys stamped in?
Tundra.
So there's no more toy, right? Because after a while, when you used to have the stamped tailgates and you had the lettering raised with paint, sometimes some of the letters, they'd take them off and they would just leave toy on there.
Yeah. Toy on there, or yeah. Yo. That
was... Or yo, right.
So how'd you get around the stamping issues then?
We sat down and worked with PE, you know, gave them the challenge, and they worked until they could figure out how to make the blank properly, how to hold the blank in the press, and so that we didn't have what we call shock lines or lines coming off those tight radii. There's some fuel adjustments, you know, but instead of going from an R20 radius to an R30 radius, you know, we might have went from 20 to 22. So when you look at this truck and you look at the styling sketch, they're pretty close.
That's got to be unusual Toyota is such a manufacturing-driven company. For you to get the manufacturing guys to change their stamping process to match the design that you want has got to be, I'm not going to say unprecedented, but highly unusual in Toyota.
It was a little bit tough, but everybody knew what the end game was. The great thing about working on trucks is I don't have to get the engineers excited about working on trucks. It's a product that speaks to a lot of them. A lot of them drive trucks. So when you start asking for things like the Toyota grill and the TRD Pros, you know, those are things that are like, well, I'll design that for you. Don't worry about it. So I have some of that momentum, some of that excitement behind it. But, you know, engineers like challenges. And that's really, I'm an engineer. That's what you live for, is the tougher the challenge. When somebody tells you that something can't be done, that's what you want to solve. That's the program you want to work on.
You know, it almost seems to me that, you know, speaking of the issue of stamping and what Toyota's doing, and you know, of all of us here, you're probably more familiar with a lot of stamping operations than many people. But, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, you guys used to have that limit of the number of hits you could have on a particular panel.
Still do.
Is that four?
Four.
But somehow, you know, you're able to get that. And I was talking to the chief engineer for the new RX and talking about forming the panels for that. And, you know, it almost seems as though now that Toyota is becoming more style conscious in terms of what it's all about, that, man, you guys are starting to form metal in a way that people haven't seen necessarily before on mass production vehicles. And I think we're going to see a lot of very, very exotic shapes coming out of your plants.
It's exciting, you know, and again, it's a challenge. And that's what if you're a true engineer, that's what you live for, is that challenge. How do you take what can't be done and figure out how to do it? How do you solve those problems?
And you guys have had the small truck landscape in North America, the sandbox, pretty much to yourselves for a long time, right? There have been some competitors, but you guys, volume-wise, are significantly ahead of everybody else. That complexion of that segment is changing now. You've got GM back in. There's talk of Ford coming in with a new Ranger. How does that inform the way you engineer trucks?
Actually, it doesn't. It's great to see the competition back in. I really enjoy
it. Hasn't hurt your sales at all.
No, actually, it's allowed me to go back to the board and ask for more things. But we've increased our production. We're selling every truck we can. And the great thing about the GM twins coming in is they brought more awareness to the segment. The segment is the fastest growing one out there right now. I think competition is good for everybody. It's going to make better products. And I'm happy to see some of the other companies come in. So we know Nissan's coming shortly with a new truck. We know Honda's getting back into it.
Where are the buyers coming from? Because just as the GM twins have not affected your sales, Tacoma or Tundra, hasn't affected the sales of the Chevy Silverado or the GMC Sierra. They're big ones either. So is the whole pickup segment now starting to grow?
Well, I think you've seen the full-size pickups segment growing since the dark days of 2008-09. Doesn't seem that long ago. But, you know, we were at 2.5 million units, and the industry went down to 1.2 million units for total pickups. we're recovering. We're still not to that level, but I think there's a renewed interest again. So full-size trucks pretty much have fully recovered and are back at their pre-2008 level. From a compact segment, we're really just returning to what the segment used to be. Mm-hmm. And the more awareness of the segment, the more competition the segment, I think, is good because it's bringing those customers back in. Hmm. The interesting thing to me, though, is that the demographic for a compact buyer is perfectly different than the demographic for a full-size truck. We like to call the Tundra a wee truck or a family truck, and we like to call this a me truck. So it's really about that personal, individual lifestyle vehicle.
Very interesting. So that would explain why the Tacoma has not cannibalized Tundra or vice versa.
Yeah, so the owner tends to be older than a full-size truck customer, and they're empty nesters, and they're more active.
I would have thought it would be the kids.
I would have thought it would have been like the power sports crowd. With their
hold these bike. Thoughts, because we got to go take a quick commercial break right now. We got to give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone, who have fantastically supported this show from the very beginning. Back in a minute. Okay, we're back. We got some questions here, but did you guys have anything before we get into what the viewers are?
We just thought it was interesting that the average buyer age of this truck is actually older than that of the Tundra.
Yeah, and for us, we have two different age groups that buy the Tacoma, mainly a 55-year-old, and then we have a 35-year-old. Both are without children at home. The 35-year-old tends to be single, very active, professional, and the 55-year-old tends to be a guy like myself, right? The kids are gone, and you're looking for a toy to play with. So those are really what the truck is based on and what their needs and their requests are.
Hmm. Yeah, but that is, I would have thought exactly the opposite, that the smaller truck had a much younger demographic.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Now, when you said Desert Racer is the theme, you'd imagine that the older person would have the Palm Beach theme. You know,
but it's Iron Man Stewart, though. That's the older person.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Good point.
Yeah. And it's about them being active. Uh-huh. You know, again, as I mentioned, you know, 45% of our customers go off-road. 53% of the trucks we sell have TRD packages on them.
Wow.
So it's really about their lifestyle and fit in their lifestyle.
And for those at home, that's Toyota Racing Development.
Right. That's our sports. We have a sports 4x4 package, and we have a off-road package that goes on there. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons on the truck itself. We focus a lot on aerodynamics on the truck. We've talked about that before. But we wanted to keep our approach angle in the front. So we have best-in-class approach angle. With our air dam on our SR5, we're at 29 degrees, and on our off-road package, we're at 32 degrees. Our competitions are running around 17.3, mm-hmm. Camry 17. So it's really about giving the customer that ability to go off-road, but yet having best-in-class aerodynamics.
So that was really interesting that you mentioned that the TRD is over 50% of the model mix. One of the things that we've observed in the full-size truck market is that higher margin products, you know, the King Ranches of the world, the Platinums, have gone through the roof, and transaction prices are way, way up. Is that something that's also happening in the smaller vehicle, in the compact truck segment?
The simple answer is yes. It's hard for me to say that because of how much... You know, I'm outselling my competition 2-1. So what I can say is yes for me.
Right.
But the whole segment, I think you're seeing that the average transaction prices are raising because people are buying premium trucks.
So is there more potential to go above the range that you've currently got with more luxurious trimmings or more off-road capability?
As the customer demands something like that, we definitely are keeping our ear to the ground, and hopefully we're meeting their needs. So the more they're asking for, the more we're trying to give them.
So speaking of off-road, when we were in Washington driving this, you guys did an amazing thing where you buried, basically, the vehicle. And explain to us the technology that allowed the vehicle to extract itself from the unextractable.
It's our latest crawl control system. So With automatic transmission, our new six-speed automatic transmission, our new transfer case, we allow the truck to have crawl control. So you can have multi-train select, which adjusts wheel slippage based on driving surface. Crawl control is kind of like cruise control for off-road. Again, it's taking the latest wheel sensors and the ability to read each wheel slippage independently and then react to it. But it's controlling the throttle and the brake pressure by itself. So all the driver is doing is steering. And what it's looking for is when we went up and buried the truck in the sand, what it's looking for is how much are the wheels slipping. It's going to determine that it's stuck. And then it's going to oscillate those wheels similar to, you know, a washing machine. And it's going to move them independently so that it's just moving a little bit of sand at a time. And it's going to build a sand wedge up underneath the tire and allow the truck to drive out. It's something you couldn't do on your own, because you couldn't control each wheel independently. But the software in the vehicle is taking all that wheel slippage information. And as a wheel is slipping, it's saying, you know, if I let it make a half turn, I can build up this amount of sand. And it's pulling that sand down in the hole. And then it'll do another wheel and the front wheel. And independently, it's moving those wheels to build that sand up. And by bringing a little bit of sand at a time, you can see that truck start raising out of the ground and to the point where
it's amazing. And what we should point out for anybody who's not seen this, we're talking about literally the frame rails sitting on the ground and the thing being able to dig itself out from under that.
Yeah. So that's why, you know, in Washington, I wanted to make sure I told the driver, make sure you spin the wheels really good after all four wheels are stuck. You know, so you can see that, we're sitting on the axles. You're sitting on the axles. You're sitting on the frame rails. The truck is stuck. There's nothing that it's grabbing.
Right.
And then you allow it to dig out. And after racing Baja last year and getting stuck in the silt, you know, every time I see it, I just think, wow, this would have been 4 hours out of my day trying to dig this truck out during pre-running.
Hey, we've got some time for some questions from the audience. Armand wants to know. He says, I know you can't speak about future product, but will the next Tacoma have a diesel or lots of aluminum? Or is there any technology along those lines that Tacoma would have that you wouldn't have considered before?
You know, we're always looking, and even in this vehicle, in the body structure, we have a lot of technology that we've never done before. There's different ways to lightweight a vehicle, aluminum being one of them. We took high-strength steel and ultra-high-strength steel. So in this truck, we developed a new hot stamping process, and we took our typical 270 megapascal steel that we use in the body, which is a mild steel, and we typically go up to maybe 440 megapascal steel. Well, now we have 440, 590, 980, and 1480 steel. 1480 steel you can't form in a normal press. You got to heat it up, cherry red, and then you form the steel. What that allows us to do is get more strength and rigidity out of the sections and reduce weight at the same time, because you're taking the wall thickness of the steel down. So the thickness of the steel is reduced, but the strength of the steel is much stronger. So we get a stronger body than we had in the previous generation truck. We have new safety requirements that we put in here. But what that does is it gives us a much firmer and stable ride on road and allows us to do more things off road. So again, that QDR.
Kayville Kia wants to know, how's the reliability data collected in the field that then gets incorporated into a future design?
That's a great question. We have several different areas that we access data and do data mining. You know, the simplest being what dealers come in or customers come into the dealer and complain about. But we do that globally. And any problems that we have globally, those problem sheets come across my desk and says, you know, this is an area that we saw, you know, please pay attention to it. One of the most interesting one is I was getting complaints from oil fields up in Alberta, Canada. And the fender liner, the plastic fender liners were getting ripped off the trucks. And we do a lot of testing. I import dust from all over the world and dirt from all over the world. And I couldn't reproduce this situation. So they're sending me pictures, and it's mud that's getting caked up underneath the fender liners, and it's pulling them off. So we went up to Alberta and we looked at this mud, and it only occurs after ice out, after the frost leaves the ground. The mud they have up there is kind of like concrete, and it builds up underneath the fender liners, and you can't power wash it off. It just keeps building up and building up and building up. So we went up there and looked at it, and it's very dense. So after a time, the amount of mud on there was more than what the plastic clips that we used could hold that fender liner up, and they would fall down. So we've changed, we're bolting our fender liners on now. We changed the construction of it, and I'm importing mud from Canada for testing.
I love that stuff. I've never heard of engineers importing dirt and dust.
But, it gets back to designing to a global requirement. Mm-hmm. And we may not have the same failure modes here that we have in Africa, but we're going to build the truck to those standards, and that's what gives us our QDR. So, nothing gets me more excited than when I have a customer come up and says, for instance, in San Antonio, was driving the rent-a-car shuttle bus, and he says, oh, you work for Toyota. He saw my jacket. I said, yeah. And he says, what do you do? I said, well, I'm in charge of the trucks. And he says, well, I've got a 2001 Tacoma with 756,000 miles on it. And they wear that like a badge honor. So when we talk QDRs, how do you get them to last that long? The downside of it is I make my living by selling new trucks, so I wish they'd buy more trucks. But, it's really about getting them there and getting them back, whether it's new or has 200,000 or more miles on it.
It's amazing. Mike Swear is very interesting. Thanks so much for bringing the Tacoma in. Thanks for coming back.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is great. We had some more questions and all, but it's been great having you here. Tell some of the background stories as to how this truck came to be.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you.
Well, good. We'll be back in just a moment. We got to give a shout out to our friends at Henkel for sponsoring the show.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
So we have no shortage of other news to talk about this week.
No, we don't.
Nothing happened this week.
But we have an interesting number here.
This will
lead to a discussion, as you'll soon discover. Okay, so Ben, if you could get ready with the first number, which is it's a date, September 29th, 1913. So if we do the math, we realize this was 102 years and 2 days ago. Something happened.
Yeah.
And what happened was...
let me guess. Can I guess?
You can guess.
So is that Diesel, a picture of Diesel?
Rudolf Diesel.
And is that the date he disappeared over the English Channel?
That is... You're absolutely right. He disappeared from the deck of the... Dresden, that was the name of the boat. And so he was sailing from Antwerp to Hardwick, England. He was on his way to open a plant. And so as it turns out that his body was found floating in the English Channel on October 10th in the North Sea. I was in the North Sea, so he floated. So
the heightened drama.
So what it was that they thought it was suicide. But others think it was murder.
Yes.
Because he was on his way to open a diesel plant in England. So if we think about those dates, 1913.
This is a year before, not even a year before World War I.
World War One, yeah.
And the Germans are going, wait a minute, Dr. Diesel is giving away the plants to a really good engine.
That's right. And but just for those who are factually inclined, he patented the diesel in 1892, so there was some lag between that. So that's the fun thing.
Wow, great date.
So you're saying it's a bad time of year for diesels, just in general on the calendar.
I was thinking there was a possibility of time travel here that we could think of that maybe somebody went back to try to stop the
The
guys at Wolfsburg wouldn't do that. So Volkswagen sales were up just a little bit. It's like
We just got sales
0.6%
for the last month. Yeah, one half of 1%. Yeah, 0.59 or something that. I don't have the breakdown yet. I'll have that maybe tomorrow of what the diesel sales were. But I think they're lucky You know, the market's red hot. Oh, my gosh. I think the SAR was over 18 million.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're benefiting from a red hot market. But, you know, this whole scandal blew up, what, about a week and a half ago or so? So they still had three good weeks in the month. You know, one bad week. I think next month the sales will probably be terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's, what, 20% of their model mix is diesels, so it should have a pretty serious effect on it.
But nonetheless, I got to admit, I thought sales would be a lot worse for Volkswagen than they turned out to be.
Well, I mean, I was looking at their numbers, and there's, you know, there's a number of Golf variants that they didn't have before, which now they have, and so the standard Golf sales were actually down for the month, but these variants brought it up a bit, so I think that's
the GTI, the R, even the e-Golf helped.
Yes, so you have those things, and that certainly helps out. But yeah, I mean, everybody else, boy, they're really doing great.
Red hot.
It's just unbelievable.
As far as Volkswagen goes, do we know that if they've ramped up incentives at all to keep traffic in the dealers?
I don't think they've done a thing. I think all the dealers are...
Because they can't sell them.
Not on diesels, but they can sell everybody on the petrol cars.
Well, you know, Wolfsburg's got to decide what's the deal here.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to buy these cars back? Are we going to give incentives to buy new ones? Are we going to pay the cost of emission? You know, nobody knows any. I'm not even sure Volkswagen knows what it's going to do next.
Right. Well, and I mean, they've got to prop up their dealers now, too, because they've got all that money sunk into these cars that they can't sell. That's a significant amount of their floor plan. I mean, if you have, you know, 5-10 cars, I mean, you're talking real money.
Hey, have the sales been banned in Europe? Or are they still selling these cheater diesels?
I think it may be country to country within Europe. I want to say Sweden may have banned the market.
Oh, you know what? Mm-hmm. No. Maybe I can answer my own question, because they've said that the Euro 6 diesel, the new 288 engine, is not got the cheater software in it. So presumably that's all they've got in the showrooms right now. Presumably.
Yeah.
So what do we make of some of the other numbers that have come out? I mean, it seems that, you know, we've talked a lot about how crossovers are taking more and more of the market, but cars didn't do too badly. I mean, just straight up vehicles were doing fairly well.
It depends. You know, I haven't looked at all the numbers, but for example, Honda Civic had a blowout month. But the Accord didn't do very well.
Well, the Civic is at the end. There's going to be a new Civic.
Right.
And that's it.
It's blowout sale. Yeah. Get all the old ones out. But Accord sales were down, and substantially Fit. The Honda Fit took it really on the chin.
Yeah, I couldn't understand that one. Why
it was
way
down like 80% or something. What the heck happened?
And I looked and I saw that the Ford Fiesta, which is arguably competitive to the Fit, is up 67.2%.
67.
Wow. Well, clearly, the Fit people walk down the street to the Ford dealer.
I mean, but maybe, just maybe, I'll have to check to see something here. I'm wondering whether, you know, because the Fit and the HRV are built
same
in the
plant.
Same plant.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they switched the production. That makes a lot of sense.
Especially with the higher margins of that product.
Right.
And, you know, that plays right to the whole issue of the crossovers being of more interest to people, and the HRV certainly.
Well, not only that, but for the dealers, higher margins. Yeah. So what's the sales person going to do? Move you into an HRV.
Right. You like the interior flexibility of the Fit? Well, how about a little bit of a higher ride height?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Let's see. Honda HRV, 4,600 for the month. Honda Fit, 1279.
I was going to say, we're not talking about really big numbers.
No, we're not talking about. But
that's a nice little car, too.
The HRV or the Fit?
Both.
Yeah. So the Fit down 80.7%.
Yeah. That number caught my attention, right. Yeah. So, yeah, because that's what I was looking for. How did passenger cars do? And I think you got to look model by model to see whether they did well or not.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, it would just seem to me that, you know, As we're seeing this growth, it's almost as though, you know, the rising tide is lifting all the boats rather than just lifting some of the boats, and that, you know, you're having this mixture of things. I mean, I was very surprised to see that Lincoln right across the board was up. I can't remember the last time that happened.
No kidding. Yeah, no,
yeah,
I haven't seen those numbers.
It was the MKZ was up. The MKS was up. The MKC, of course, was up. That's their small crossover. MKX was up. MKT
Wow. Even the MKT?
Wow. They must
have
got, MKT was up 66%.
There must have been a big fleet order.
They sold another one.
there was a fleet order.
All right.
Instead of one.
Yeah, so they sold 430.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to 259 last September. Navigator was up. So every single vehicle in their lineup, I mean, it's just like really astonishing. And you want to talk about big numbers. The MKC is up 184.2% this year over last year.
Man.
So, you talk about
it was just coming into the market then, right?
Yeah.
So
talk about a hot product, though. I mean, those guys have to be, deliriously happy with that thing.
I saw even Cadillac sales were up for the whole brand. Mm. But ATS, I think, did well. CTS went nowhere. And even though they've got certain models of the Escalade, just the not the ESV or whatever the heck it's called, is that was down.
The Escalade ESV was down 3.8%. They sold 1,181. The ATS was up 2.5%. CTS down 42.2%. ELR down 67.6%. Escalade down 28.9%. But SRX, okay, again, I mean, when that's going to be replaced by, what is that, the CT?
The XT6, is that?
Or XT6 or?
Something like that. XT6. Still have the
I have no clue.
Whatever that thing
I
will be.
I never even learned SRX.
Whenever it'll be called, but I mean, the sales of the SRX are up 85.1%.
Yeah.
So 6,849 last month. I mean, that's pretty darn good.
But to your point, even Cadillac's up. So the rising tide is raising all boats.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you'd asked me if we'd see an 18 million plus SAR this year, I would have thought, nah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
So, boy, I just can't believe how red hot the market is right now.
So, do we think it's going to last?
At this clip, no, I don't. But I think for the foreseeable future, we're still going to have a nice market for the next year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, others are saying we are going to see an 18 million SAR, not for the year, next year. So, at this snapshot in time, I think the market's going to get even stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's these cheap gasoline prices are paying off. It's like giving everybody a big tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
So what else? Speaking of sales, the Pope did not sell more 500Ls.
All right, but there was not enough time in the reporting. I mean, it's just, come on. It's just like, so he was driving around, what, he got here last Wednesday, was it?
Something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, and everybody that was...
Give the Catholics time to get the checkbooks out.
They were all watching them on TV, or they were in the crowd, therefore they didn't have time to go to their dealers. But, I mean, I was amazed at how many shots I saw.
Yeah.
MSNBC had like almost wall-to-wall Pope coverage.
Right.
Even the Weather Channel had Pope coverage.
And I mean, it's just like, they just had his motorcade. I mean, it's just like, yeah, there it is. Yeah, he's in that vehicle. And you just see the 500L. You got to believe that there are a whole lot of people saying, oh, what is that the Pope is in?
Yeah.
And
well, then it's a natural fit because they didn't have to change the greenhouse to accommodate all of the headgear and all of that.
And then he switched into a Jeep when he wasn't in Fiat.
Was
he was in a
great
Jeep.
Score.
So we'll see if 500L sales.
I predict they'll be it'll rise like.
But last month they dropped 46%. So.
And again, we're talking small numbers.
Okay, quick break right here. We're going to give a shout out to our friends at Dodge.
Worry about predators like our ancestors did. No saber-toothed tigers stalking from the brush. No dire wolves circling the camp. There are no more monsters to fear. And so we have to build our own.
Okay, we're back. So another big news that just broke is this Fiat Chrysler UAW contract has gone down in flames. Chris, what do you make?
You know, it's the wage structure issue, right? It's and we saw it was interesting that there were some that were ratifying and some that weren't, and it I didn't really dig into it too
deeply.
Yeah,
no, it went down in flames.
But it looked like it was going down early. Yeah.
There might have been a local here or there that approved it, but overwhelmingly rejected. Gary, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, the official statement that came out of FCA today has a couple of precious paragraphs in it. And the memories of our near-death experience in 2009 are vivid to this day in the minds of most of us at FCA. Of course, FCA didn't exist in 2009, but that's another story. A large number of new employees have been brought into the group since then who, thankfully, did not have to endure the pain and sacrifices that were required of the workforce then. But it is that knowledge and those memories that continually reinforce the FCA leadership's resolve to never let those events repeat.
Wow.
Which means, don't come back to the table, boys. We already negotiated this agreement.
So what are they going to do?
I think we're smelling a strike.
Yeah.
Because I don't, to that statement, I think FCA is not going to say, oh, yeah, come on back and, you know, we'll give you a better deal. Sure, we'll give you a better. No, I don't see FCA doing that. And yet, the members have made it very clear, unless you get rid of those tiers, we're not approving this thing.
But, I mean, I think, wasn't everyone surprised at how quickly they seemed to come to an agreement when the bargaining happened? I mean, it wasn't the usual drawn out, and I mean, they announced that it was going to be FCA. They went, they negotiated. Then,
but remember, they've been negotiating since July. Or
right, but I mean, that always happens. But I mean, it seemed to me that in this case, they were very, you know, businesslike in terms of getting it done and, you know, announcing, okay, we have a
contract.
Well,
they did go beyond the deadline, but only by a few hours.
Very, very small amount. Right, and, it seemed like a heck of a deal. But, you know, it's a situation that, you know, do they go on strike or does the UAW say, okay, we're going to put you on hold. Now we're going to go talk to the guys at Ford, or now we're going to go talk to the guys at General Motors and see what we can get from them. And then, depending on that, then we'll get back to you.
Well, they are going to have to get back to them. And, you know, what the union could easily do is just say, let's shut down a truck plant or a Jeep plant. And maybe that will convince them they got to come back to the table. But I don't know where it's going to go. I'm not even sure anybody knows where it's
going. You know, I thought it was a peculiarity of the thing where they were discussing about how they would build trucks and SUVs in the U.S. and then move passenger car production to Mexico. And I was thinking, well, their main vehicle production is in Canada with, you know, the 300 and the Charger and the Challenger, right? And so cars there, what, the 200 in Sterling Heights, and then the Darden Belvedere.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's not all that many cars being built here now, but, I mean, doesn't that tell the production worker who is working in one of these facilities at Jesus Gasco's high again? And, you know, we just heard Mike talk about how trucks went down by, you know, what, 50% or so? How confident would you feel that you would have a job? And, you know, when trucks go...
Well, they're not confident, and that's another key reason why they rejected it. I think the different tiered wages is the key one, but there's some other issues, healthcare stuff and some other things, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you had said even a week ago, I think there's going to be a strike, I would have said, nah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, these hourly workers rejected it conclusively.
Yeah. When was the last time there was a strike among the big three?
Well, there were strikes in the late 90s against General Motors that were horrifically costly to the company. And but that's the last time I remember that there actually was, you know, a shutdown.
Is that the one where they shut down the metal center?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Well, there were two strikes right around that time frame, but one of them was that.
So you couldn't get stamp parts to build trucks, so
right,
it's just like, you know,
that's
sort of screwed there.
So but kind of interesting that that all broke in the last day or so. What else?
So Tesla revealed the Model X, and so I know that Tim Stevens wrote about it, your colleague at CNET.
He did. He did a yeoman's job. He took a flight early in the morning, flew out there, drove the car, then flew back on the red eye, and then was on CBS this morning, in the next morning. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, I was quite surprised. So I watched Musk's presentation, and the thing that really struck me about it was the amount of time that he spent discussing how safe the vehicle is. And he broke it down. I mean, at least a third of the half hour that he spent talking about the thing was to safety. You know, they said this is the safest SUV ever, first SUV, 5-star in every category. And then he started talking about how they accomplished that. You know, he's saying that, you know, if you have a normal SUV with the engine in the front, you get in a frontal crash, that, you know, the engine block can go into the passenger compartment. And but they have the motors and batteries down low, and there's space between, you know, the front of the car and in the passenger cabin. And then he was talking about, you know, we heard last week, force over distance, when we had the pilot in the studio, in terms of safety and crash. Then he was talking about side pole intrusion, that for the Model X, it's 215 millimeters, and the next best is an Audi Q5 at 448. And he's saying that's the difference between life and death. I mean, that seemed to be a pretty...
If you've got that kind of delta between your vehicle and the competition, I would talk about that, especially with an SUV where it's, you know, these days it's a family vehicle, right? So that's, you know, you're talking about the welfare of the children in the back, and he went through the whole thing. He talked about the, you know, the Falcon doors in the back and how much easier it is to get in and out of the vehicle to clip in the child seats and all that. So he went through the whole thing and really sold it as a family vehicle.
Yeah, and he was talking about, you know, we had twins because he's got like a zillion children, I think. just the difficulty of, he was talking about, you know, putting them in their car seats. He says it was sort of like trying to stick them in a hole back there, and now we can do it. But, you know, again, I mean, it was none of this stuff that you'd associate with Tesla. Like, he wasn't, I mean, he got to the end where he said, you know, this goes so fast it's wrong, you know, when he was talking about the speed of thing. But by and large, he was basically selling it as this is the most functional, utile, safe vehicle you can possibly get into.
Well, that's not a mistake then. No, so that, I got to believe their research tells them they're probably hoping to attract a whole lot more women buyers with this vehicle, or certainly drivers. And, you know, if you're going to talk about putting children in the back seat very easily, safety is of paramount concern for parents. And, you know, this is something that Mercedes especially has been selling, how safe they are. And I could see somebody saying, well, I like that Tesla X, but is it as safe as my Mercedes? Mm-hmm. And so I got to believe that's a key reason why.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he's rolling out to give a shout out to that pilot. So when he was talking about the rollover injury risk, that they're at 8.1 in the Honda Pilot and Acura MDX. And we had the MDX cutaway in the studio last year. They tie for the next best, but they're at 16.4 compared to Tesla's.
All that weight down low.
Yeah.
All the battery.
And, but, you know, I was quite surprised. I mean, I really thought it would be more razzmatazz rather than this is how functional we are. I mean.
Hey, question. Did the original X concept have Falcon doors on the front as well?
I thought it did.
I thought it did, too.
Yeah. So that was an interesting departure. You know, there may be a whole bunch of different reasons for that. It could be cost. It could be structural rigidity. It could be all of those things.
I think
things.
They just couldn't get them to work with wind noise and leaks and all that.
Yeah,
so they
maybe.
Did second row doors as Falcon wing doors.
Yeah. It's definitely interesting. And when I look at the size of the apertures for those doors, that may be, you know, one of those things that subliminally people who are looking at the car go, is that safe? Because those open an awful long way. There's a lot of...
Well, the other thing, our friend Anton, who follows Tesla more than I think Elon Musk follows Tesla, made the point that the doors, the Falcon wings, when they open up, take up a lot of room.
Okay, that I read Anton's missive about that, and then I watched the thing, and this really, really, really surprised me. So they explained that there's two hinge actuation.
Okay. So the lower half of the door?
And, well, it goes up. So basically they showed they parked two vehicles that were a mirror's width away from the sides.
Very smart demonstration.
Okay, so, you know, a tight parking space by any measure, okay?
Right.
And one of the two cars was a Honda Odyssey, so on the right side was a Honda Odyssey. And then he goes, okay, we'll open the doors. And what ends up happening is they open up. They go up like this.
So they pull away from the body a little bit and then go straight
up. And then so, and this was amazing. He said that the ultrasonic sensors that they use compute the opening arc depending on
the available space.
The available space.
Wow. Right.
So that they know that they can fit in garages.
Yeah.
And he said, we invented a new ultrasonic sensor that reads through the metal, so there is no exterior pucks as are ordinarily the case. So, yeah, I mean, it's just like...
We've got this up on video on the screen here.
And then he showed, you know, you could try and get in and out of the Odyssey, and when the door is open, obviously the door comes out on the Odyssey a little bit, and he couldn't really get in and out
from the back. Yeah,
right.
Ah. Yeah, so I mean, it's
not an issue.
No, but I mean,
reliability issue.
Well, that might be.
But
right?
It is a really spectacular demonstration in smart thinking.
Now, I'm impressed.
See, and you know, we talked about this before. I mean, you know, the design that these guys have had, you know, I mean, here they are. They have a sedan that looks drop-dead gorgeous, and they're doing all of these things. And, you know, it comes back to the question of, well, how come it's this little upstart company in Fremont, California that's doing this versus somebody in, Stuttgart or Detroit or, you know.
Or, yeah, Toyota City. It's because the guys in Detroit, Stuttgart, and Toyota City know that this is impossible to do.
Yet there it is.
And, you know, and what it sort of strikes me is that you know, Chris probably doesn't remember, but I know you do, that when Lexus first came out, that all the guys in Detroit said, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. They can't make that LS. That's impossible. Yeah. How'd that work out for them?
Right.
So, you know, I'm not suggesting that that's what's going to happen with this company, but, man, I mean, it's so great to see that here's this guy who's coming from somewhere else and saying, you know, oh, I want to put the kids in the back, and therefore let's just make it a whole lot easier than anybody else has done.
Yeah, I mean, down to little things, like the sunshades are, they return home on magnets, right, instead of these cumbersome clips that often break and all that, and they're, you know.
Great idea.
Right, how simple is
how
that?
How simple is that? Right.
Right. But there are some interesting things. You know, you wonder about replacement costs of things. It's got a huge windshield that goes all the way up over the first row of seats. And A, you wonder what the solar gain is on something like that, because it doesn't have, like, what does Mercedes call that? The magic sky control?
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't have that electrochromatic glass that can change its opacity. I think it's just a gradient. So you've got something like that. What is a replacement windshield cost on a Model X? That's going to be...
I don't think anybody buying a Model X is going to worry
terrifying.
About that at all.
Yeah,
I think,
fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, base price, $132,000. So.
You know, remember, the LED headlamps that Audi uses, replacement cost at the dealership is over $3,000 a piece.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think once you get into that stratosphere... The OEM doesn't care what the cost is because they want that look, and they know they're going to sell cars just based on the look. So it costs a lot, whatever. We'll just bake that into the price. And I think that the people buying them, they're not going to think for a second, what's the replacement cost? Mm-hmm. That's why you get insurance. They let them worry about
mm-hmm.
it.
So GM announced today that it's going into mobility in a big way. Did you see that?
Yeah, I just read that right before we started.
Yeah, and so they're carrying on their autonomous vehicle development. They're even having a car sharing program. I thought, wow, this sounds fantastic.
Right.
General Motors is going to have a car sharing program. And then I read the details in the car sharing program.
It's out of like one hotel, right?
It's one. Okay, Let's Drive NYC, that's the name of it, it'll be in New York City, is available to eligible residents of the Ritz Plaza, a 479-unit luxury apartment building at Times Square in Midtown Manhattan. Okay, so now keep that in mind. The Ritz Plaza, a luxury apartment building.
I know where you're going with this.
Okay. So I'm
thinking, what's the car they're going to offer?
What is the car they're going to offer? So the fleet currently includes 8 Chevrolet Trax and 2 Chevrolet Equinox.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Spark.
Well, it's almost, for God's sake. I mean, it's the Trax. It's the little thing. Okay. I thought it was going to be Cadillac. I honestly thought...
It's in New York.
That's what I thought.
It's the Ritz Plaza.
Yes. The Trax. Well, I mean,
even have a nice interior for the class.
Couldn't they have done the Buick Encore?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's a slightly upscale Trax, right?
Right.
They're also going to do an e-bike, GM announced.
Yes.
You know, and let's see, there's another crosstown company here that also talked about car sharing and an e-bike earlier this year. I think it's that one with the blue oval.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, these two companies, they just seem to copy each other.
Yeah, it seems, but...
Everybody wants to be viewed as a mobility provider and not just a car company, so we're going to see more and more of this type of stuff.
But, okay, so does nine cars make a car sharing service?
I'm not even sure it makes a press release, but there it is.
it's just like, okay, you could get like three or four of your friends together,
yeah,
and you could have more vehicles than they have.
I'm guessing that's going to be driven by the help, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, if you're in luxury apartments, you're going to be like, oh, you know, please grab the, you know, the tracks and take the kids to whatever.
They'd rather get Uber Black
and
go out in a tracks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was very surprising to see.
Weird.
I thought, wow, this is going to be great. They're going to have all these cars. And I was like, that's it? It's one apartment building?
But you're right, Chris. Everyone's getting into this car sharing stuff. And they're trying to talk mobility services, but none of them are doing that. You know, it's all car sharing to this point. We'll see. It's interesting that GM and Ford both are talking about electric bikes.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting because now you're getting into more than just car sharing. Now you are starting to dabble in other forms of mobility.
Okay, but do you honestly think that you'll be able to go into your local Chevy dealer or your local Ford dealer and be able to buy a bicycle? I mean, anytime in the reasonable near future?
No, I don't.
So what's the point?
Well, I think the point is if you're really going to be a mobility services company, you got to walk the talk. And you can't just say, well, we've got car sharing. You got to be able to say, we've got an app that'll give you all kinds of mobility. And it may not just be an electric bike, by the way. It can be used on the subway or the bus or the train or whatever other kind of mobility thing there is there. And they're all thinking right now, they have to control all of it. The OEMs are thinking this way. And so that kind of thinking says, yeah, we should be making bicycles too. I highly doubt they're ever going to do that. I really do. There's plenty of other bicycle manufacturers in the world right now who
major city like Paris or Barcelona or Chicago, and they all have bike sharing. I mean, it's just so.
And is, in this case, GM developing the bike? Are they manufacturing the bike?
They developed it in Oshawa.
No, look, the guy who was one of the chief designers on the Ford F-150 designed the Ford bike. He's also a hardcore bicycle guy. So it made a lot of sense. And it does make sense if you're saying, hey, this industry is going into mobility services instead of owning cars. We're going to share cars kind of a thinking. Everyone's dabbling in it right now.
And just think if this whole bike thing plays out, then Peugeot will become the number one automobile manufacturer since it started as a bike company.
There you go. That's exactly right. So, well, look, we ought to wrap it up. We've had a really good show here today. Mm-hmm. Chris Pockert, thanks for coming back on.
Always great to be here. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Gary, next week, this is your show.
Next week, Mike O'Brien from Hyundai Motor America will be here. We'll be talking product development of new Hyundais. So it'll be
that ought to be good. Mike's a good guy. I'll be out of town. I'm not going to be here, but the show will be in good hands.
Thank you.
Real good.
Thanks.
Okay, we're signing off, people. Thanks for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.